WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report in the U.S. House.
The ayes are 217, the nays are 215.
And House Republicans push their big budget resolution to passage, a crucial step toward delivering President Trump's agenda. It includes $4.5 trillion in tax breaks and $2 trillion in spending cuts. House Speaker Mike Johnson.
We had the requisite number of votes to move this process along, and now passing the budget resolution in the House, it will go to the Senate.
The plan had stalled over concerns about potential cuts to Medicaid, and CBS's Caitlin Huey Burns points
out. It's important to note that in this specific bill, there isn't a line item to cut Medicaid, but there is an item to make heavy, heavy cuts to government spending. And a lot of lawmakers have pointed out that really the only way to achieve those cuts is to make some changes to Medicaid.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
This is your local Civic Media radio station.
Want to hear even more? Anytime?
Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
The Brewers' spring training continues. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, the Brewers trying out players and adding familiar faces like Mark Canna, returning with a minor league deal. He could serve as a DH or first baseman. The Brewers losing to the Mariners 12-8. On Sunday, left-handed pitcher Aaron Ashby struggled in his first outing against the Rockies, coming off shoulder surgery from nearly 2 years ago.
Even though it's frustrating, frankly, everything felt pretty good. I felt a little bit of rush, maybe a little adrenaline, just getting back out there for the first time. But healthy.
College basketball, the Badgers back in action at the Kohl Center against the Washington Huskies. Greg guarded practice after Saturday's overtime loss to Oregon.
It will be a good learning experience for us if it hasn't been already. We've gone through the film. But then you got to flush it. As I said to the team, I said, we didn't have a parade last week when we beat Purdue, right? We're not going to have a funeral today when we lost. You have to keep it in balance.
That's Badgers head coach Greg Gard with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Skilled trade workers are the backbone of every community and also the Army National Guard. Soldiers trained to keep the power flowing, engines running, and in every other trade needed to accomplish the mission. These soldiers are on the fast track to learning skills that can set them up for success at home with companies looking to hire the best. Their resumes are being built through their paid training and part-time service. Find out how you too can learn a trade profession by visiting NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about the kleptocrats. They're talking about giving a little money away. I had a couple of people today, Red Hat friends, going, we're getting Doge money. We're getting Doge refund money. Woohoo! And my response was, yeah, I'll believe that when I see it. But when the kleptocrats are dangling carrots, maybe be afraid. Now, the carrots, as you dig into what the kleptocrats are offering. Now, understand, what you're seeing Musk and Trump and the Trump administration doing is they're crushing any opposition, anyone to hold corporate America, the wealthy in check. They're crushing, which is why, you know, they went after and they were destroying the independent regulatory agencies. You know, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, you know, the Federal Election Commission, those folks, the people who, you know, they're the cop on the beat to kind of, you know, hold the greed monsters in check and have some guardrails on laissez-faire, unregulated, unrestrained capitalism, you know, to where one guy, you know, like Elon Musk, is able to hoard, yeah, some half a trillion in wealth, while we've got millions of people who, well, toil below the poverty line. Because, hey, we can't possibly raise the wages. But the argument now is doge money. We're cutting spending, and we're going to give it out. We're going to give out, I guess, $5,000 is the doge number. Until you start looking at what they're really, what the basis of it is. And the basis of it evidently is only taxpayers, you know, actual taxpayers who aren't going to spend the money. We only are going to give it to people who pay taxes and don't spend the money because we don't want it to be inflationary. Not like that Joe Biden and that $1,400 that caused all of that rampant inflation. No, no, this $5,000 won't go to the rabble and the unwashed masses. No, no, this will just go right to the wealthy people who don't need it. And they're very open and honest about it. And they, in fact, they say that if we give the money to people who don't need it, they'll save it. And it will actually be deflationary. So think of the logic here. We're going to crush all those programs that poor people need. We're going to go after Medicaid, and we're going to go after Medicare, and we're going to go after SNAP, and we're going to go after all of this quote-unquote wasteful spending. And we're going to redistribute it out of the mouths of children, out of the heat in homes for seniors, out of the health care for the indigent and seniors, and we're gonna give it to rich people who don't need it. That is brilliant. And you have people who are clamoring for it. Because the higher you go up the socioeconomic ladder, the more you get people who are paying taxes. Now, interestingly enough, one of the people I was speaking to has children. And I asked, you know, did they qualify for the earned income tax credit? And the response was, you know, kind of. And I said, don't be ashamed. I think it's a great thing. I think it's a great Ronald Reagan's program. It was Uncle Milty's idea. This is purely a conservative Republican baby. The earned income tax credit, you worked. And, you know, we're just helping you a little bit. And sheepishly said yes. I go, well, you're not eligible because you're not a taxpayer. You didn't pay anything in taxes. You got more than you paid in. This isn't for you. Now, what I find interesting, again, I go back to the kleptocracy. I said during the first term of Trump, it would be the greatest criminal enterprise in history, and was. And now kleptocracy number two, when you have, you know, someone like Musk and the oligarchs who are now fully entrenched in our government, try not to be shocked by the amount of theft that's going on, especially when they've crushed any bit of oversight, any bit of challenge to their power. And now they're offering trinkets. Now they're offering a little bit for us. And look, we'll take it if it comes, the blood money that it is, because it will come at the expense of the desperate and the needy. And that's okay with these people. In fact, it's preferable. This is why they got into government, not to help, but to enrich themselves. And the faster we learn this, and I had, you know, one of the people, well, why aren't you in the streets marching against us? I go, look, it's going to have to be the people who are affected. Because clearly you didn't realize that they meant you. And I think this is one of those grand epiphany moments, an opportunity for people to get their heads right as bad things happen to them. Sadly, it has to happen this way. And I said this back after Election Day. Sadly, we have to go through this kind of figuring out which side we stand on. You know, because as I was reading through this, I couldn't help but think of my high school government teacher, who was very clear. You know, when asked which party should I look toward, he said, look, you know, Republicans are going to be for the rich and big business. Democrats are going to be for big government and the poor. And you folks in the middle, you got to decide who you're going to pay for, who you want to align with, because you're going to pay for both. And clearly what we're now faced with is, are we now willing to take from the mouths of children and from the lives of seniors the trinkets, the couple of bucks of blood money? Is that who we are now? It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Now, personally, I don't think it's coming, but you never know. And then I want to see them do mental gymnastics on how it's not inflationary. Well, if you save it, then it's not inflationary. crazy. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, like everything else, crazy. You know, just insanity coming out of D.C. And as I said yesterday, Democrats need to get out of D.C. Just leave. Save yourselves. Get out. Adopt a Republican. Get into those Republican districts. And go to those places where, you know, Biden had done some investments, some jobs were being created. And now, because of Trump's insanity, it stopped. The wind industry, oddly enough, very popular in red states. Take Iowa, take Texas, a lot of red states, big on wind. But according to a Wall Street Journal article, the U.S. wind power industry, they're freaking out because everything is at a standstill. And what's that mean? It means red states aren't getting the power, aren't getting the jobs, aren't getting the money, aren't getting the investment. This is where Democrats go to those states, highlight those issues, and maybe you get a, you know, get your government hands off my Medicare moment to wake up the Republican congressman in that district. So, again, adopt a Republican. But here to share some thoughts on manufacturing and, you know, these jobs. There were jobs producing windmills stopped. So I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts with us. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's great to be with you.
So what do you think of the idea, getting into some of these places where the investment had been flowing, jobs were being created, wealth was being accumulated, communities were getting better, workers were optimistic because, hey, I got a good job, maybe a union job, and now done.
Yeah, I mean, it is a, first of all, I don't understand Trump's fascination with like the wind turbines, right? And we don't need to go into that in detail because we've talked about that before.
But you mean it kills all the birds and causes cancer?
It's a little mind boggling to me.
It kills whales?
Yeah. I mean, the issue with wind is that, and I just want to say for the record, I'm for like an all of the above energy policy.
Sure.
I want it to be American made. I realize, you know, natural gas is part of this for a while. Nuclear has got to be part of it. You know, solar, geothermal, wind, all of that. Right. OK. And the issue with wind is that it's very capital intensive. And you nailed it, that a lot of the states where it's very effective happen to be red states. You know, there's a lot of wind in Texas, right? There's not a lot of mountains to break up the wind.
It's Iowa.
Exactly. My home state of Indiana. In fact, there's wind turbines from basically Purdue University on up to where, you know, I live, like 30 miles to the north. It's unbelievable to see it. And they're still farming, obviously. But, you know, so there's been a lot of investment in it, and it can generate a lot of electricity, but it's one of those industries that, you know, where the return on investment, it's going to take a little bit of time. You don't want to pump money in if you think it's going to get shut down in the next couple of years, because you never recoup that, right? So that's one of the issues. And then it's clearly, of all the renewables, the one that Trump, you know, seems to be going out of his way to try to harm. But there is a danger to this. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, wind is a part of the Texas energy grid now, right? It just is. And if you take that out for whatever reason, it's not going to be a good outcome for a lot of folks in Texas during peak demand or other issues. And just lastly, you know, a lot of, there is a potential, if we were to grow wind, for a lot of manufacturing jobs in the United States. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these things up close and personal, but it is an impressive machine with a lot of steel, a lot of steel in those things. And so that is a market that we're basically ceding to China and other countries if we don't participate in
it. Yeah, I remember seeing them come through our area on the trucks, just the blades, how big, how massive those blades are, and you know how incredibly skilled those truck drivers are to be able to move those things around. Just amazing. But again, for me, it's this inconsistency, this crazy neurotic back and forth that, I don't know, it's not how you would run a company. I know we just want government to run like a business. It's not how you run a business, and it's certainly not how to run the most powerful government on the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't disagree that, like, the quote unquote chaotic or madman approach to, like, foreign affairs or negotiations, you know, does have some credibility. It clearly does, right? It can work in the right circumstances. But I don't know that that applies particularly well to energy markets and to capital markets where you need that long-term signal. Yep. And I think that's the, you know, that's the challenge for something like the wind energy. And so, yeah, it's not helpful and it's not surprising that some of that is drying up. And again, these are not, I mean, some people will say, you know, we used to call those green jobs, right? But they're red, white, and blue jobs. And a lot of them are in red states. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, a lot of these jobs are in red states. And so I don't want to give that up, but I don't know what my, you know, I don't know that I want to put odds on what the outcome of all of this is.
Yes. Now, look, your organization is nonpartisan, and I completely understand that. But I do find it interesting that the red state governors are the ones that are squealing at some of these policies. I know the blue state governors knew they were going to be on the hit list. I'm just not sure that the red state governors knew it was them when they were advocating for, well, these kind of neurotic policies. But I do want to move along because, you know, there's a lot of stuff, China happening. For instance, I understand that the Trump administration is proposing some fees on Chinese-built commercial ships coming into the U.S. Anything to do to help, you know, save our trade deficit or fix that, I'm in favor of. What do you think of this approach?
Yeah, so this is actually we're going to get into trade jargon again, but a Section 301 case. And this was a case that the Steelworkers Union, the machinists, the IBEW, the boilermakers, and some of the marine trades, maritime trades, filed together and asked the Biden administration last March to say, basically they said there's unfair trade practices in Chinese shipbuilding and they're preventing us from having a shipbuilding industry, okay? And so the Biden administration looked at it, said, yes, this is true. But they obviously went out before they could propose anything to do about it. And so that is what Trump has done on Friday night. The administration kind of very quietly in the Federal Register published some possible remedies for this. And one of them, yes, is charging any for there's a couple of layers to this. So if it's a vessel of Chinese origin, and a lot of cargo containers are, if you've ever seen them pull into a port, you'll know what I'm talking about. You know, there could be a fee of like $1 million and it can scale up and down depending on a couple of things. If it's actually from a Chinese shipping company itself, then there's another fee on top of that. And that can be offset if the shipping company is using American ships or buying American ships. And then there's also a requirement that over a period of number of years, because we just can't whip up a shipbuilding industry, it actually takes years to develop, but that a certain percentage of U.S. exports must be carried on U.S. vessels by U.S. crews. Okay. And so, you know, I like this idea. I think it has a lot of merit. And it, and yeah, the, if you think about the value of goods on a cargo ship, it is, you know, in many cases, you know, tens and tens of millions of dollars. And so like a fee, $1 million fee, you know, will a shipping company feel that? Yeah, they will. If you disperse that among all the cargo on the ship, is that ever going to be passed on to consumers? No, it probably isn't. So it's actually a pretty elegant way of generating some income. Now, here's the other thing. I don't want this income to go to pay for a tax cut for, you know, for people making $400,000 a year. I want it to go into a fund that would be training workers for shipbuilding careers, because they just, you know, that training system is very small right now, because we only have a handful of shipyards, and to offset the capital investments that the shipyards would need to make and the supply chains would need to make to scale up, to tool up, to actually build more ships, which will be needed, because, you know, you just can't magically do that. It's expensive to build a ship, and it takes a great deal of skill. So again, first part of this, we're making progress. Second part of this still needs some work. And the other thing, and this is what worries me, this also gives the opportunity for the foreign shippers and like the Chamber of Commerce and everybody to come in and say, we don't like this, because it's basically going to be the equivalent of a tax on consumers. And so there's a hearing that the trade office will have, the U.S. Trade Representative, I think on March 24th, and they'll hear this out, and then they'll make a decision sometime after that.
Yeah. Now, here's my problem. I like the idea. I like the idea a lot. Just like I like the idea of restricting foreign investment, Chinese investment into the United States. I like that. I can't believe we've allowed the Chinese Communist Party to buy up our farmland and our property. I can't believe we've allowed that to happen over the decades. So I'm in favor of that. My problem is, and I keep coming back to, you know, who this is coming out of, and then how he's going to spin this to benefit himself and not us. Because again, I like the ideas. They just seem to fall flat every other time that they've done some of these things. So that's where I'm at in this.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I want to see, and I'm just, my approach so far to this administration and trade has been to watch what they say they're going to do and to understand what they say they're going to do, but to pay even closer attention to what they're doing,
right?
You know, what's in effect. And as of the time we're recording this, the one actual trade step that's been taken is a 10% across the board tariff on Chinese goods. I like that. I'm just going to say, I think it's a good policy. And when you add that up to the other tariffs that are on Chinese goods that were put into place by Trump, and also some that were put into place by Biden, by the way, you know, the average tariff on Chinese products right now is about 20%. So, which seems, you know, actually a little low to me coming from China, but that's the one thing that we've seen. Now, you know, in a week or two, we'll understand what's going to happen on aluminum, steel, what's going to happen on Mexico and Canada, and a wide variety of other things. But that's the sum total of what's been done so far is this 10% tariff on Chinese products.
Yeah, and look, like you, I think that should be higher on Chinese products. And I know everyone's going to be screaming, oh, it's going to cost us more. And I'm, you know, the reality is I'm okay with it costing a couple pennies more if it means my neighbors have jobs, if it means that we reshore manufacturing and have a manufacturing base once again. I'm okay with that, because look, and this is, we've talked about this before, I was told I was going to have the choice. I was going to be able to go to Home Depot or to the hardware store, and there were going to be two hammers on the shelf, one made in the U.S., one made in China, and I was going to get to choose. And I would always choose the one made in the U.S. I don't get that choice anymore.
No, you don't. You know, there was a great story. I think the Washington Post did a story about auto workers in Michigan and how they're feeling about Trump's trade policy. And, you know, there was a couple of workers, and one was like, one had voted for Obama in 2008 and then voted for Trump, you know, in 2012, and then voted for Trump three times. And he said, look, I'm not I feel, you know, I'm happy to pay $300 more for a flat screen TV if it means that I'm not selling out my kids and my grandkids, right? And you know, because that's selfish of me to want to pay less for a trinket when we're sacrificing our economic and national security. I don't know that most people feel that way. It'd be interesting to find that out. But I thought that was really interesting coming from, and it wasn't just him. There were other workers who basically said the same thing, who felt all of this pain, you know, from globalization and bad trade deals, and who basically said, look, you know, it might cost more for a flat screen TV, but I'd rather have security for my kids and my grandkids than, you know, to pay a little less. I don't know that most people think that way. I wish more people did. I think
we've had this conversation before, Scott. I mean, it's where you view, are you a worker first or are you a consumer first? Clearly, right. Those people were talking as workers, saying, look, I want to have jobs for my kids. I want to have, you know, employment here in this community. You know, I want what our grandparents' generation had. We built what we consumed. We are domestic production for domestic consumption. And if we can get back to that, it means paying a little bit more. I'm all on board. My problem is, you know, we end up paying more and it goes to the wrong people. It goes into the hands of Musks and the Bezoses and the rest of them. Then I have a problem.
Yeah. If we stop investing in manufacturing, whether it's wind or automobiles or semiconductors or infrastructure, and it's just about the tax cuts, that's not going to work. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
So you can put, you know, massive tariffs on things, and it's not going to work to bring production back. So, yeah, you got to have that combination. Like you with the audio board, Rick, you know, you got to have all the levers and you got to be able to push them all in the right direction. It just can't be tariffs, you know, up to the max and everything else down to zero. That
perfect,
doesn't work.
Perfect analogy. Finally, I got to get your thoughts on evidently a story out that the Chinese Communist Party, not the workers, not the people of China, but the Chinese Communist Party, that they're using AI to monitor people like you who might be critical of their people like me who might be critical of their policies, and evidently using lawsuits, defamation lawsuits on, well, people who they may want to silence. Are we worried about that?
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about our experience with that before, getting sued by the biggest Chinese car company that has connections to the government. And we won, but it wasn't pretty. But now it's seeping into academic institutions and researchers. And this is worrisome because, you know, these are the folks that, we do some policy work, right? But these are the folks that expose what's happening, right? Expose what's happening in China and who are able to talk about the Uyghur, slave labor and issues like that. And now they're being targeted by Chinese companies with connections to the government. And not only that, as you point out, there, you know, the Chinese Communist Party is using AI to monitor criticism. And yeah, I suspect they're paying attention to things that we're saying. What worries me even more is the attention they'll be playing to Chinese dissidents and others, and then the leverage that they can put on their families back home if they're saying bad things about China abroad. And give it, you know, having, you know, them use a tool, whether it's DeepSeek or any other sort of AI for that, is horrible. And it's not surprising. But again, going back to the people who say, well, we're going to pay more. Okay, this is what's being financed with our trade deficit, basically, right? There's been a massive trillions of dollars shift in wealth to China because of this shift in production. And this is what it's producing, a police state that is not friendly at all to the United States of America.
And all those dollars that we send over there have to come back, and they end up buying us. And we've allowed it. And this is the part that's been so frustrating to me over the years, is we get these cheap trinkets and that money has to come back. And they've bought industry after industry. And as I understand, since you brought up education, they spend a lot of money funding various projects throughout the educational institutions. So that I would assume, and I'm going to make this assumption, they give that money with the strings attached that you don't say bad things about us.
Yeah, there's been a lot of attention paid to that by the China, the Select Committee on China now, these Confucius Institutes. And unfortunately, yeah, there's a lot of like whitewashing of the record. And there's again, tracking of dissidents as well, which is really troubling to me. And so more and more universities are severing their ties to these. But yeah, because they, I think they realized, as you said, Rick, there were strings attached. I want to say for the record, I want Chinese students to come to the United States and learn
Certainly.
And see how great this country is. I do not want to cut that off. I think that would be a terrible, terrible idea. But it doesn't mean that we have to bring the police state here.
There you go. Scott, as always, I appreciate the input, the thoughts. Thanks for keeping us up to date. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
You bet. Great to be with you, Rick. Thanks so much.
Our good friend Scott Paul. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
The Tap. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A cloudy sky, some rain showers tonight, and lows in the mid-30s. Any rain wraps up early tomorrow, mostly cloudy and mild, highs in the mid-40s. In the low 40s, Thursday with a mix of sun and clouds. Near 50 Friday and breezy. Currently 35 degrees.
How was your drive to school?
Let me tell you. I had to get my iced coffee first. I just can't seem to put it down. My favorite rapper just announced a tour. My phone was buzzing like crazy. I'm so excited. I had to text all my friends right then to talk about it. Then, someone started calling me and...
Let's try that again.
I turned my phone off right away. I never drive distracted.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, you know, I'm looking at the nominees and the people that Trump is putting into positions of power. The latest name that popped up, grabbed my attention, was Dan Bongino, the talk show guy. He's been evidently named deputy director of the FBI. Yes, the guy who does the podcast. He is now deputy director of the FBI. And I started thinking about, maybe I better worry because he blocked me on Twitter. He's not happy with me and some of the things I said to him. So now that he's got this gig, and look, we're weaponizing government at every opportunity. I don't put it past these folks. But evidently he'll be the number two under Kash Patel. Scary times. Here to share some thoughts on where we are, what things are happening, and maybe if we're going to get a budget. I've asked my good friend, former Ohio Congressman Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
What do you think of Bongino as deputy director of the FBI, given the fact that he's got no FBI experience? He was a cop in New York, I guess, spent some time with the Secret Service during the W and Obama years, but nothing in the FBI.
Right. So he's had background, you know, because at first, and I wasn't familiar. I should have been, but I wasn't. At first, I thought, okay, does he have any law enforcement? Yes, he has some law enforcement, Secret Service background, but nothing within the actual FBI itself. So I was surprised because usually you have some type of, you know, background within justice if you're going to be in a higher level of the Justice Department. But it was an appointment that surprised me.
Not me, because look, you know, it's all about the loyalty. It's all about the patronage. He runs the podcast, has been nothing but effusive with praise for Trump. So not even a shock.
That part of it, I did understand because that's what's happening these days. But usually you try to find somebody that's had an experience with, you know, within an agency.
Yeah, and sure, why not? Let's move on. Over the weekend, I'm sure you saw the big dust up on federal employees. Musk had his little tweet and then he emailed with, you know, hey, tell me what you did or you're fired kind of thing. Does this bug you?
No, I mean, here's what I think. Don't take the bait. Now, why I say that, this is not going to be a weekly occurrence. What did you do last week? Federal, follow this for a second, federal workers, taxpayers paid. So what you get is if they don't respond, except there were certain agencies exempt. For example, Secretary of State exempted him, Cash Patel exempted the FBI, but and Homeland Security. But here's what I mean by the debate. I have people that message me and say, well, you know, I pay their salary and I'm a worker. And why can't they tell what they did if they didn't do anything and they can't tell it, they shouldn't be there. So when I say don't take the bait, if they just say, well, I'm not going to do it, it allows Musk to say, well, you know, you obviously can't say what you do. Or do you think you're above the people that pay you? I just think it's one of those gimmicks.
No, I agree. But who the hell is Elon Musk? Who is Elon Musk to be able to say, yeah, screw your chain of command, screw the person that you work under. You now answer to me. That's the part that I'm struggling with.
Well, it's all, again, it's an accountability thing. Musk, for example, had made statements about somebody was 150 years old receiving Social Security. They weren't. But it did show that there's an old, and I'm the last person to talk about electronic technology, all right, but an old COBOL system that nobody uses anymore. So in doing some of the mess up things he's done, he cuts a nerve on the other hand, you know, of waste in agencies. He found a line item that no one knew where it went to in the Treasury Department, but yet they made erroneous statements about other agencies. So it's a hit and miss thing, and they'll take the hits and they'll exploit them amongst the headlines. That's simply what this is about.
Yeah, and we're gonna all get, we're all, every taxpayer, not every citizen, every taxpayer. It means you had to actually pay taxes, not more than your refund, more than you paid in. But people are going to save the money and not spend it. We're going to get a doji refund. $5,000 is what I'm hearing being pitched around.
As much as I would love to have a refund of something, it's not a good fiscal policy. Never has been. When Bush doled out the $600. Now, the stimulus checks, during a crisis of the proportions of COVID can be looked at, I think, differently. But when, you know, Bush doled out, I think it was the $600. Yeah, people got $600. That's great. But if you look at the collective whole and can put it towards the deficit, if it's put towards the deficit, that's a better fiscal choice than to send checks out. Also, there can't be $5,000 per person. It will not amount to that type of check.
No, it's not per person. If you read the details, the person who came up with this was very clear. This was not to be inflationary, so we can't give it to poor people. Can't give it to people who are going to spend it on stuff, Bob. Only the people who are going to pay off their debt, save it, save for college, not use it. You know, people who don't need the money. You know, the people in the upper income brackets, those are the folks that we're going to get this money. Nobody making under $30,000, $40,000 a year is going to see any of this money.
Okay, I'm against that.
and so are they. But for me, this is a massive redistribution scheme by the kleptocrats who are going to literally take food out of the mouths of children and heat out of the homes of seniors and health care away from the indigent to give people who don't need it even more. That to me is this administration at its heart.
And this scheme never works. Like I said, I'll go back to George Bush. It doesn't work. You're giving small amounts and people see it and wow, okay, that's $500-$600 when they did it back then, but it doesn't help the good of the whole. So with the minute I heard it, I thought, okay, if you're trying to be fiscally sound and you're trying to balance things, don't do that.
Don't do that. Because again, I want to see the mental gymnastics, as I said at the beginning. I want to hear the Bonginos of the world tell me how the $1,400 that Biden gave out as part of the stimulus to save our economy from collapse, how that was massively inflationary, but $5,000, it's actually deflationary. I wanna know the mental gymnastics that go into making that argument.
Well, there aren't too many. Again, there's a lot of gimmicks out there.
There you go. Got to get your thoughts on privatization of the Postal Service, or at least I shouldn't say privatization. I should say Trump taking it over, you know, much like he did the Kennedy Center. Talking about taking over the Postal Service or merging it, or doesn't know, but something.
Well, the Postal Service has been a weird hybrid. Now, every year, postal workers would come in and meet with me, both the postal union side and the management, and they would come in and meet. And then we would talk about how the Postal Service was private, but yet it's not private because Congress makes laws that affect it. It's a weird hybrid, almost like the Amtrak, was. So when you talk about privatization, it's something that we would already be taking a hybrid privatized entity anyway, and then you further do what with it? I think the big question is, what would you do with it? How would you run it? The other worry I have, if you're going to have a postal service, which historically in this country has, from the days of riding on horses, has distributed mail to all part of the country, you can go back to rural electric cooperatives. Those were funded and founded because of the fact that the mainstream private utility company didn't want to go into rural areas, Appalachia areas, Tennessee. That's how you got the Tennessee rural electric
Valley Authority, yeah.
They didn't want to go in there. And so those cooperatives were formed to give, the vast hinterlands some electric, which probably would never have been for decades, if that. So when you look at this, you have to say to yourself, if it's privatized, if I'm a corporation completely running the Postal Service, and I look at it and I say, well, it's just not profitable driving those trucks way down those rural routes, of which I used to represent, 16 counties worth, right? It's all rural. Then somebody might make the decision, we're just not going to deliver mail there.
Yeah.
That's the cautionary tale I would say about turning this all over, just like private prisons, into a profit mechanism. Then you might have a big problem on service.
Yeah, see, for me, I see it a little bit differently. I see it as a massive land grab because the Postal Service owns an enormous amount of property.
That's true.
And I've been into some of these processing centers that are, a million warehouses, facilities that are a million square feet that the Postal Service owns in prime areas. So for me, I keep looking at we're gonna buy it, we're gonna break it up, we're gonna sell parts off, we're basically going to kill it in the name of saving it while robbing it blind of all of its resources. That's what I see coming.
I never thought about that. That would be some prime property where you could say, well, we could sell this and keep that.
And then you slow down service to the point to where nobody uses it anymore. And the rest of it's got to go. And now you have an entire at the mercy of the public, at the mercy of private entities to do any of that. And then the prices skyrocket. Because I can send a letter across this country for 55 cents. That's that's what the last stamps I bought. I got like $5,000 worth of stamps because I send out a lot of mailers. That's incredible to me. If we privatize this system, I guarantee it doesn't stay there.
Mm-hmm. True.
Just my
It would change.
Yeah, I got to get some of your thoughts on the international stage. I look at Zelensky offering to resign to get Ukraine into NATO. That's never going to happen. I look at this Pete Hegseth and just the bumbling idiot that he's been on the national stage. What are we seeing coming out of Ukraine? Are you paying attention to any of this?
Well, yes, Hegseth, obviously, as a newbie, for sure misspoke on the world stage. J.D. Vance, of course, stepped in as the VP and made it clear where, you know, Trump was at on the entire situation. And when you look at Zelensky coming out and saying, well, you know, I'll resign if either we get peace out of it or if Ukraine's accepted into NATO, that's not a deal that's going to happen.
Right.
So, you know, his resignation would not bring that about. Now, what the claim is made about Zelensky is the fact that there hasn't been an election. Well, under the Ukraine constitution, if you have martial law ongoing, then you can't have an election, and they have martial law due to the war. So that's the reason right now there hasn't been an election. If Zelensky steps down and says, let's have an election or we'll go into NATO, that's not going to happen. This is not a direct trade for Zelensky stepping out. That is not the way this runs. So we have a two-track approach right now. One is the meeting that was held in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, with Mohammed bin Salman. Now, what's the key to that? This wasn't about Mohammed bin Salman, who, by the way, is not the king of Saudi Arabia. His father is, but his father has Alzheimer's, so Mohammed bin Salman is technically the acting king.
Right.
This wasn't about Saudi Arabia hosting this event, Rick. This was about Saudi Arabia participating in this event. That's a big deal difference. Now, Israel, of course, wants an economic deal with Saudi Arabia. Everybody knows that. Saudi Arabia wants a deal with Israel. So what I see is you have the meetings with Russia. They're over with. Rubio was over there. It was Russia. The second path is where we sent an envoy into the Ukraine to talk to Zelensky, to ask him for his raw materials to pay back whatever loans were out there for our munitions and warfare equipment. That's the second track. The other point is that Zelensky was not part of the Saudi Arabia talks. So this was America, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. I think, Rick, somewhere in between, this becomes what Saudi Arabia wants to do with Israel to get a deal, what Israel wants to do with Saudi Arabia. You throw in the Palestinians in there somewhere where Saudi Arabia asks the Trump administration to do this or that with the Palestinians. And then you got Russia as a whole separate plate of business where the U.S. is going to have three goals: to reestablish some type of diplomatic beginnings with Russia. All right. All of this, as you can note, does involve Ukraine. So
Zelensky's out,
they're part of a peace process. They should be, if you're going to have one between Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah, I was waiting for the part where Ukraine gets, what?
No, there's no Ukraine part to this. It's Zelensky fighting Trump. It's been a weakened status with the Republicans anyway for funding. And you haven't had Zelensky as part, well, the Ukraine. I should not just point out Zelensky, but the Ukraine is part of the process. So this has taken a whole nother life. And now it's coming to privately third party involvement with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Palestinians. So now what happened when Russia went to the Ukraine? We have to remember this too. Saudi Arabia and Israel said, well, United States wants sanctions, but I don't know about doing that with Russia. So you can see Russia's holding the cards.
So how you see this playing out then?
Well, I see it playing out that at some point in time, they're going to begin to further do direct talks on the Ukraine and Russia situation. When I say they, meaning Saudi Arabia, the United States, some of the allies will come along, although the United Kingdom said, well, we're going to send in troops. Well, good luck with doing that. So I think at some point in time, the Ukraine is probably going to see that they're going to lose some land on the eastern part of the country. And that's probably, Rick, going to be the, quote, peace process to give up and yield that land. That's what I see happening.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Bob, as always, I appreciate the insight, the thoughts. Good stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney, want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you think? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. That was the day a general strike by workers against the Nazis took place in Amsterdam. The Nazis had begun the occupation of the Netherlands in the spring of 1940. The German occupiers implemented a series of increasingly repressive anti-Semitic laws. In response, some young Jewish men in the city formed self-defense groups. They clashed with the occupiers and local residents who supported the Nazis' policies. To make an example against Jewish resistance, on February 22nd, the Nazis rounded up more than 400 Jewish young men in Amsterdam. They were deported to a series of concentration camps where most were killed. The Communist Party in the city issued a call for workers to stand up against this anti-Semitism. Their call was to strike, strike, strike. Working groups across the city responded. The general strike began on this day in labor history, with public tram drivers leading the strike, causing public transportation to ground to a halt. Factories and department stores all stood silent. Students walked out of classrooms. The next day, the strike spread to other nearby towns and villages. The Germans' response was quick and harsh. It crushed the strike on its third day and leveled a severe blow to Dutch anti-Nazi resistance organizing. It's estimated that between 75 and 80% of the Netherlands' Jewish population perished in the Holocaust. In 1952, a large statue called the Dock Worker was commemorated in Amsterdam in memory of the workers' strike. Each year, a ceremony is held at the statue to recall when workers stood up together against hate and to renew the promise to never forget the victims of the Holocaust. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I've got a lot of response from the people saying, hey, good idea. Adopt a Republican. And rightly so. Look, I think Democrats do need to get out of D.C. I think they need to get it to where the people are and create some of these photo ops. I got an email from Brian. He says, I was in a town hall phone call with my congressman, Emmanuel Cleaver. I heard all kinds of questions about DOGE. How are you going to protect Social Security and Medicare? He says he's a Democrat from the KC area. He had no answers to our questions. I hung up not feeling very confident about what he was saying. He said, I agree. The Democrats should go home. Get out of there. We'll see what happens. Thanks for what you do. And look, got a bunch of those. But I think you do have to go to Republican areas and get them worked up. Because when Republican politicians see their constituents getting all riled, for instance, don't know if you saw this over the weekend, and I can never say it right anyway, Cordarline, Idaho, I always screw that up. Evidently, there was a town hall. The Republicans were holding a legislative town hall, and the talk turned toward the repeal of Medicaid expansion and a number of other bills that were working through the Idaho legislature. And you know, some folks were not thrilled at the idea of repealing the Medicaid expansion because it helps poor people, helps working people. And one of the women, you know, basically just was hogtied and ripped out of there. And it became this kind of spectacle that forces you to pay attention to what the issue is. Now you got the person who was at the head of the stage saying, you know, I've got a bigger microphone. You know, look at this little girl. You know, look at her. You know, I can say whatever I want to. And it was very, very Republican of them. And then accused the people who were being basically hogtied by the police as filibustering. And you go, you need to have these moments where the passions of the people become crystal clear. And you need to create those environments. You know, like I said yesterday, I'm about 45 minutes from Lebanon, PA, where the guy famously said, "You get your government hands off my Medicare." A learning opportunity, because Medicare is a government program. And I see us in one of those moments to talk about what good government is. What we're seeing out of Trump and Doge and Musk and all of them, this is not what good governance looks like. This isn't what running anything like a good business is like. This is chaos for the case of chaos. This is all about destroying something. And I look at this event in Idaho, where, you know, working people deserve a voice silenced by the Republicans there. And interestingly enough, is getting a little bit of play in, hey, you know, maybe we do need to hold on to Medicaid. Maybe we do need to hold on to our government who does things to help working people. This to me, again, I know it's hard to see the silver lining in this, but as I've been saying all along, they're going to overreach. They are going to do what they're inclined to do, and that's to fill their pockets too much. They're going to grasp for it all. And in that, we're going to suffer. And this is where I implore Democrats, go out there and hear those stories. Go out there and highlight those stories. Because understand, the Republicans are about ready to implode. Trump, I think James Carville is right. I think he's about to collapse because Republicans can't go home. Because they're going to meet these kind of town halls. They're going to meet these kind of events where people are going, hey, this is not what we wanted. You're making the economy worse. You're taking what few investments we liked away. And you're making it harder for us to buy eggs. I don't know. Again, eggs never higher and inflation up. That's not what people voted for. So, like I said, you know, the reality is let the Republicans give them enough rope to do what you do. Because, you know, Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, said on Monday that he wasn't planning on making any changes to the budget to make anyone happy. So that Medicaid cut that they've got in there, the idea that they're going to slash and burn Medicaid, that doesn't get fixed. And do you know who gets a lot of Medicaid dollars? Republican voters. So when you go home and you got, hey, get your government hands off my Medicaid, you're going to have a moment, Democrats. You're going to have an opportunity. The door will be open to then go in, highlight that situation, and have an idea of how to make it better, how to fix it. Because you can. Smart policy does win, but it's got to be heard. You've got to have the ability to go out there and sell it a little bit. And that comes with highlighting the fact that people are going to get screwed over. That all of these gimmicks that Doge Boy and his ferrets, all of the games that they're playing, eventually will turn and bite them in the behind. And we want that because they don't have your interest or my interest. They don't have our interest at heart. They don't care about you or me. They care about themselves. And this is a kleptocracy. They are robbing us blind while they're dividing us with their nonsense. Don't let them do it. That simple. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. freespeech.org for the video. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The House votes along party lines to approve a Republican budget resolution. House Speaker Mike Johnson after the vote.
Now passing the budget resolution in the House, it will go to the Senate. This is the first important step in opening up the reconciliation process. We have a lot of hard work ahead of us.
The bill proposes $4.5 trillion in tax breaks and $2 trillion in spending cuts. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
A Republican bill could cut $880 billion in just Medicaid alone, throwing 80 million Americans, kids, veterans, the elderly, to the wolves, just to get their friends big tax cuts.
CBS News has confirmed that large-scale firings are expected soon at federal agencies. As reported by CNN, the Office of Management and Budget, along with the Office of Personnel Management, will issue a soon-to-be-released memo to tell agencies to submit reorganization plans.